The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Continuing the theme of refuge, I thought I'd start by reflecting on an analogy that Bhikkhu Bodhi offers for these three refuges. He speaks of these three refuges as not really being separate refuges, but really three aspects of one refuge, that they work together for us. And the analogy he offered was the analogy of a doctor who recognizes, understands an illness, and has a medicine that is useful to cure the illness. So if you're sick and you go to the doctor has the understanding, the wisdom, and the medicine. And the medicine is what actually cures us, perhaps, if we take it properly. And we may need some help. We may need attendance or support, caregivers, while we're taking the medicine to help us take it properly. And so this analogy, he points to the doctor as being like the Buddha, the medicine as the Dharma, and the attendance as the Sangha. And that all three function together with our own willingness to take the medicine. And it's not something that we can, that the Buddha can just kind of proclaim, or the doctor can just say, you can be well now. We have to actually take some action. We need to act for ourselves, to be willing to take the medicine, to undergo that course of treatment, and perhaps have some support while we're doing it. And so we can see in this analogy, as Bhikkhu Bodhi sometimes says, the Dharma is the true refuge, the freedom, the possibility of, as Gil said yesterday, the freedom from those forces in our mind that create stress, suffering, dissatisfaction, unease, suffering. So the freedom is possible. That's the true refuge, the freedom and the steps that we can take towards freedom. And yet, we need the others to support us. As Gil said yesterday, the refuge in the Buddha is really understood to be a refuge in, I would say, in confidence in the Buddha's awakening. We take refuge in the understanding of the possibility that a human being can free their minds from these forces of greed, aversion, and delusion. This freedom from greed, aversion, delusion. That is actually the most succinct definition that I know of, and the one that I resonate most fully with, for freedom, for Nibbana in the suttas. Freedom from greed, freedom from aversion, freedom from delusion. This indeed is Nibbana, the Buddha says, the suttas say. And so refuge in this possibility of awakening. The capacity of our human minds to be free from greed, aversion, and delusion. Part of the reason I really resonate with that definition, I think, is because the idea or the sense of freedom from greed, aversion, delusion feels possible to me before I really started looking at my mind and looking at what was going on. I had some ideas about enlightenment, And they seem to have something to do with a big bang in my mind, where suddenly everything would be different and I would be different. And it was just, it was so fundamentally different in my mind. It was just a fundamentally different, like, altered state or something. And while I do have an appreciation that the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion is what we would call an altered state, it is also, can be a very ordinary experience. One that we can meet, we can know in this very life. It doesn't require some kind of transcendent some kind of separated from reality state. And so this capacity for awakening, this possibility for freedom from greed, aversion, delusion, the confidence in that is one definition for refuge in the Buddha. At one point when I was on one retreat, I was at Jikoji practicing on retreat, and my mind was in a state of struggle, of feeling like it was really hard to be mindful. The mind kept just slipping out. Didn't feel like I could do the practice. And in that state, while I was telling myself, this is impossible, I can't do this, I've completely lost mindfulness, I took a step and I knew the step. And I didn't try to do mindfulness there. I just took a step and the mind knew, was aware of the sensations of that step. And in that moment, for me, that brought alive in that moment a sense of refuge in the Buddha, because I could see in that moment I wasn't doing that. It was a capacity of the mind, the possibility. The mind had the capacity for meeting experience that was separate from my deciding to do it or not. It was just this capacity, a human capacity. And in that moment, my mind said, I can take refuge in the Buddha. To me, that connected or resonated, that I was connecting to the capacity for awakening in that moment. And that's kind of how I'd like to explore this today, this looking at this capacity for just this ordinary quality of mind and what it opens for us. Now, mindfulness is a completely, really ordinary function of the way our minds work. I think of it as being really based on kind of the self-reflexive capacity of our awareness, that we can know that we know something. So it's an ordinary quality. We have it as human beings, this capacity to know that we know, to be aware, to be present for what is happening in the moment. It's a simple capacity of our human minds. We don't have to do it. We don't have to create it. It's part of our humanness. And the awakening, I think, is connected to that capacity. And yet this capacity to know that we know is not, I guess it's not really enough. I think the brilliance of the Buddha was really to highlight this capacity that we can know that we know, and then to recognize that if we cultivate that in a certain way, if we use that capacity with a certain perspective in mind, that is what opens us to the freedom. And so this capacity to be aware, to just simply know that we know, is a natural human capacity. And yet the perspective that the Buddha says we need to bring in order to move in the direction of freedom from greed, aversion, delusion, in order to free the mind from the forces that create stress, suffering, dissatisfaction, unease, all of the reactivity that we experience. We need to cultivate that quality in a particular way, the quality of awareness in a particular way. The classic or definition of this would be right view needs to be present with mindfulness. Right view, the first factor of the Eightfold Path. So wisdom, some kind of wisdom needs to inform how we know that we know. And if you go talk to somebody, just somebody on the street that's angry, somebody who's never really met the Dharma, and you go up to them and say, "Do you know that you're angry?" Probably they'd say, "Yeah, I know I'm angry." But that kind of knowing that they were angry isn't the kind of knowing of anger that will lead to freedom from that, will lead to the releasing of that or a reorientation around it. So asking somebody who doesn't have a particular perspective in mind to notice that you're angry probably isn't going to help them too much. And in fact, that very instruction, that was one of the first meditation instructions or mindfulness instructions I played with in my practice. I read in this book, anger was really my entryway, my doorway into the practice. And I read a book that said, well, try noticing your difficult states of mind. And my initial reaction to that as I read that was, okay, so I'm supposed to know that I'm angry. Isn't that just going to make me more angry? But I decided to explore it because the instruction said something like, well, just notice what it's like to be angry. Notice the feeling. Notice that experience of anger. And that's the fundamental shift of perspective that really, one of the fundamental shifts of perspective that makes this capacity to know that we know right mindfulness or wise mindfulness. Rather than knowing that we're angry and being informed by all the ideas, the views, the opinions. Usually when there's something we're angry about, there's something we don't like in the world, something we want to get rid of, something we feel like we need to fix or change, and somebody to blame ourselves, blame others. And so when there's something unpleasant happening, often we feel like in order to be happy, or in order to have ease, I need to get rid of that thing, get myself out of this. I need to figure out how to get somebody else to get rid of that thing. And so when we become aware of something like a reactive emotion, or in this case, anger, our view of that, our awareness of it, is often informed by the belief that we need to do something with that. There's a problem and we need to fix it. And there are times when we recognize that there is an injustice in the world, and there are movements that we can take to act in the face of injustice. And yet, acting on hatred One thing the Buddha said, you know, hatred never ceases through hatred. Through non-hatred alone does it end. If we act on hatred, we tend to recreate a cycle of hatred. And so the possibility of recognizing injustice and not just simply saying, oh, there's injustice, you know, the mindfulness of injustice doesn't necessarily mean, oh, injustice is happening. Injustice. It's kind of like if you were to be standing by the side of the road and see a small child dart out into the road and a car is coming. You know, mindfulness in that moment and awareness of the situation wouldn't be, oh, seeing. You would take some action to try to pull the child back, to alleviate that suffering, to alleviate the possibility of harm. And so the exploration around shifting our perspective on these reactive emotions doesn't mean that we become non-active. It doesn't mean that we become non-responsive. So the shift for wise mindfulness is kind of like turning and looking at what is the human experience of what's happening right now. One way to look at the shift of perspective that takes us from mindfulness as a the kind of ordinary awareness that we have to what will lead us in the direction of freedom. A turning towards the experience of reactivity, recognizing the human experience. How does it impact the body? How does it impact the mind? And so the Buddha encourages us to cultivate this capacity for knowing our human experience. Being curious about being human. You know, this is supportive in not only for our own freedom, our own waking up, but also as we do this, as we recognize, turn towards the experience of reactivity and begin to recognize it as a human experience, something in that exploration points out to us, we're not alone in this. It's not just about me and my struggles, but really this mind, the reactivity that's born in this mind and body is happening all over the place. Of course. Of course we're reactive. That's kind of like how we've been trained. And so it gives us a sense of compassion and humility. Compassion for others struggling. Compassion for others acting out of their anger, their hatred, their fear, their confusion. And a sense of humility when we recognize, yeah, me too. These forces are at work in this mind, too. And so as we turn towards and get curious about the human experience, we see the human experience, not just that it's here, but all of us. I had, we're pretty early in my practice, I was really looking, again, at this anger, a lot of understanding around this anger that I explored early in my practice. But one of the insights or recognitions I had at one point, I was watching the anger, seeing, it was anger at a particular person, this particular exploration. And as I noticed the anger coming up, I would see, you know, all the unpleasant experiences in the body. I'd notice the kind of contraction of the heart. And at one point, I noticed a thought in my mind, I hope he gets what he deserves, or something like that. You know, some kind of wish for that person to be harmed or have some sort of suffering. And it was kind of a shock to me to see that wish. You know, that I wished that that person suffer. And in that moment, seeing that thought, I saw, I recognized this. So there was something about seeing that, that like multiplied by 7 billion people on the planet, and recognized, wow, no wonder there's war. No wonder. So that sense of humility that in this being too are the seeds of greed, aversion, and delusion, and we can turn with this wise mindfulness, begin to understand it, and that turning helps us to release, helps to transform, actually more transform those energies. And so there's some perspectives that help us with this natural, normal, everyday, ordinary capacity of self-reflective awareness to shift it or turn it towards the Dharma. And I'm going to talk about these in really simple ways. I'm going to offer three different perspectives that just really in ordinary language. The first one is that in exploring our experience with mindfulness, experience is just experience. Understanding that what's happening in the moment is something that's happening in the moment. Now that sounds obvious, perhaps. It sounds like a truism, and yet it's not our usual perspective on experience. Typically, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, when something unpleasant happens, and we have, so this is an example, you know, something unpleasant arises, we typically don't recognize it, oh, that's just something unpleasant arising in the present moment. Something unpleasant arises and agendas, ideas, opinion form about it. I need to get rid of it. I need to fix it. Somebody's to blame. I'm to blame. Somebody else is to blame. I need to tell somebody else what they need to do. We have a whole host of things that arise in relationship to that unpleasant experience. So typically, very typically, our perspective on something that's arising in the moment isn't, oh, this is an arising in the moment. It becomes something we need to, we have agendas and opinions and views about. And again, it's not that we would necessarily not act on some of those opinions, agendas, and views. But to recognize that this isn't arising, the opinion isn't arising, and to have some level of discernment of what's wise in this moment, what's wise action in this moment. Way more often than we might think, wise action is simply witnessing something. And yet, as I said before, there are times when wise action does call for some actual action. The Buddha in his day, my understanding is that he at one point walked out in the middle of a battlefield to try to stop a war. in the area where he grew up. They were having a water war, fighting over water rights. And he walked out in the middle of that battlefield and tried to use his presence so that people would not fight each other. So sometimes action like that is called for. That action can arise when, wisdom, when we understand our experience, we understand experience as an arising, as something happening in the present moment. And so this understanding or this perspective here on retreat in particular, we do explore this possibility of simply recognizing what's happening in the moment. A thought is arising in the present moment. A thought about the past is arising in the present moment. We understand that that isn't the past, actually, but it is a thought arising in the present. A thought about the past arising in the present. We understand that that thought arising in the present moment about the past may have ripple effects in our present moment experience. A thought arises, and maybe the thought is arising about something that, an argument that we had with somebody before we came to the retreat. Often the emotions of that experience arise now too. That too is an arising in the present moment. It's not the anger that you experienced, the frustration that you experienced, or the reactivity that you experienced 5 days ago. It's new. It's happening now. It's arising now. And we can witness that. We can see that. So this perspective of what's happening now is what's happening now, and I can know that. I can be with that. Any experience can be used to cultivate mindfulness. When we have this perspective of curiosity, interest, what is the human experience of whatever's arising? What is the human experience of frustration? What is the human experience of a thought? What is the human experience of confusion? What is the human experience of daydreaming? Whatever's arising, if we can have that curiosity to explore it as something that's happening in the moment, that creates a perspective that allows us to not be entangled with what's happening. It creates a way to observe something without reinforcing it, without feeding it. It's kind of like, I mentioned this yesterday in the small group that we had, kind of like if something, for instance, some kind of reactivity is arising, the act of turning towards it with this kind of perspective may kind of feel like putting your mind into neutral around it. If a car is going 100 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour down the freeway, you could be fueling it with putting your foot on the gas pedal, and that will keep it going. You can take your foot off the gas pedal and put the car into neutral, and it will come to a stop and kind of steer the car as you come to a stop. But you know that it will come to a stop because you're no longer fueling it. And this perspective of an experience in the present moment is an experience in the present moment is kind of like putting the mind into neutral. It allows that energy. It often doesn't stop the energy. So just coming into awareness of frustration or confusion, for instance, doesn't mean that suddenly that confusion or frustration goes poof and disappears. But we can hover with it and kind of watch the momentum of it slow, perhaps. And so this is a way, actually, in which, you know, so this perspective of an experience is just an experience. We might need to remind ourselves of that. And okay, this is frustration. Can I just know this is frustration happening in the present moment? Can I know this is just a thought happening in the present moment? Kind of reminding ourselves of this perspective. At some point, the mind will see it from that perspective. There will be the understanding, the actual understanding. Oh, this is just frustration happening, and the mind can watch it, kind of watch it shift and change, watch it unfold. And in that moment, the very seeing of that, like that moment when we feel like there's a little bit of space around some kind of reactivity. I know that you've all experienced something like this. Seeing something and having that turn of mindfulness. Oh, this is just confusion. I've been believing and caught by thinking I needed to do something with it, but I can just watch that. And there's some space, there's a shift, some ease that happens there. That, I would say, is kind of a taste of the experience of that wisdom. It's a little taste of that freedom, indirect experience. You've had tastes like this in your practice. So this perspective of experience is just experience. Experience is happening. What's arising right now is happening right now. Creates the conditions for a more non-judgmental, non-reactive presence of mind. So that's one perspective that we cultivate. Another perspective that's helpful to reflect on, to cultivate in a similar way. First, we may need to reflect on it. Sometimes call that borrowing wisdom. And thinking about what our teachers have said or examples they've given. Oh, maybe I can just be with this. Another perspective that's useful to borrow initially, but then begin to see for ourselves, is experience is conditioned. Experience comes about based on conditions. What's happening right now is not random. There are many threads that have come into your sitting in this room in this moment, hearing this talk. I sometimes use the phrase, and Joseph is the first one I heard this from, you know, experience is arising based on causes and conditions. Causes and conditions. And I reflected on what that meant to me. What does it mean, causes and conditions? And for me, conditions, in a way, are a whole set of basically, all of the evolution of the universe up till this point. You know, the Big Bang, the evolution of the stars, everything. So there's all of those conditions. And then there's our conditions of having been born in the particular country or economic circumstances in which we were born. Those are conditions. The conditions of our family and whether our parents, we had two parents or a parent died young, those are conditions. The conditions of our education, the conditions of our upbringing, the conditions of how people met us on the playground, the conditions of our physicality. You know, my eyes are bad. They started going bad when I was in first grade. Because of that, the teacher put me in the front row a lot. I got put in the front row pretty much all through grade school. And that's a condition. It's something, and that condition influences us. You know, that at one point I began to realize that that condition of having bad eyes was probably the main reason why when I went into any room where there was somebody in the front of the room speaking, I sat in the front row. I had this idea somehow that it was because I was so interested or something, but probably mostly it was because I'd been put in the front row ever since I was in first grade, and that's where I was comfortable. That's where I learned to be comfortable. So conditions, so many conditions, so vast, we can't even think about all of them. We can't know all the conditions that come into who we are in this moment. So those are the conditions. And then in this very moment, our experience is also informed by what's happening right now, how we are relating to what's happening right now. Is there reactivity in the mind? Is there confusion in the mind? Is there greed in the mind, aversion, boredom, frustration, ease, curiosity, love, gratitude? Those are also conditions in the present moment. And in a way, those are kind of closer conditions. I think of those as the actual kind of more close cause for what's happening right now. The conditions are what has happened until now, and in this moment, how we are relating to it will have a huge bearing on how we are experiencing it. And so our present moment is created from past conditions and from our response, the state of how we are right now. And we can sometimes see, just as we witness this, as we watch what's going on in our minds, we can sometimes see the shift of the conditions in this very moment having a huge impact on how we relate to what's happening right now, and what's happening right now having been conditioned. So we can see the very intimate connection between how am I in this moment, what is happening in my mind at this moment, and how I'm experiencing this moment. We might experience what's happening right now with aversion or with interest. Big difference between those two in how it's felt, what happens there. As we see this conditioning, so understanding, hearing about the conditioning, sometimes I find it a support to remind myself, right, what's happening now is happening because of conditions. At one point, I spent quite a bit of time on one retreat watching depression. I was on a retreat in Burma, and over the course of a few weeks, I kept recognizing depression being a persistent state of mind. And it wasn't an intense depression, so it was relatively easy to meet. But what I found, one of the things I found most supportive in meeting that depression was to remind myself, this is conditions. The phrase I used from my teacher at the time, Saito Utejaniya, was, this is nature. This is arising in this moment because of conditions from the past and because of what's happening right now. It's like a seed has been planted. This is the tree that's growing right now because these are the conditions that have been present. This is what's available to grow in this moment. The shift for me, as I acknowledge, just use that phrase, I just drop that phrase in at times as I would notice the depression, right? Oh, this is nature. It would often create the conditions for the mind to step back a little bit and have a little more ease with being able to know, oh, this is depression happening in the present moment. And so that understanding that it's conditioned, seeing it from that perspective, helped to be able to meet it with more ease, again, a sense of spaciousness around it. We can have a little more interest in witnessing our experience rather than being caught by it. Again, this can become not a reflection, but an actual experience of witnessing the conditioned nature. In that case, in that example that I gave, I was reminding myself, this is conditioned. This is nature. This is the bush that's growing right now. Depression bush, that's what's growing. The depression tree, okay. And that allowed me to have some spaciousness around being with it. At times we can actually see the conditioned nature unfolding, witness the process at work. You could notice this in a simple way, perhaps. If you've been sitting for a while in the hall, maybe a long sitting, that's a condition. And the fact that we're human and need to drink and have bladders, you know, that's a condition. And sitting for extended period of time, the bladder tends to fill. There's pressure in the bladder. The feeling of that pressure can arise. We can notice that. We can notice the urge to move. We can see the recognition of the urge to move, the movement that follows that urge to move, and the action of going to relieve the bladder. We can see that. I mean, we might in our ordinary state without, if we don't actually see all of that, we might just think in our mind, oh, I have to go to the bathroom, and kind of get up and go to the bathroom. But sometimes we might actually witness seeing all of those little pieces, recognizing the pressure, the unpleasantness, seeing how that pressure conditions the urge to move, conditions the movement, conditions the action. Watching it unfold in that way, sometimes it's like we just watch ourselves get up and go to the bathroom. It's like, who's doing this anyway? Witnessing the conditioned nature, we start to see the way that, well, kind of like we take credit for, our sense of self takes credit for what's happening after the fact. And all of these things happen, and then we think, oh, this is what I need to do. It's going to happen anyway. So we can see directly see the conditioned nature of experience, recognize in that kind of experience potentially, there's no I there making the choice to move. It is an unfolding of conditions, a process. We also might see another example from my own practice. I'm trying to interweave, you know, kind of the perspective that supports mindfulness and the understandings that happen as we explore that perspective, the actual moments of freedom that can happen as we explore the perspective, the little shifts. So another example from my own practice, at one point I was exploring, this was pretty early in my practice, I was exploring watching my emotions in my day, and I began noticing that I got lonely every night before I went to bed. And so I was interested in that. It didn't actually surprise me because I had just broken up with a partner, and yeah, I'm lonely when I go to bed. Okay, you know, no big deal. It didn't particularly surprise me, but I was curious. It's like, okay, well, let's just see, what is this loneliness, and you know, how does it feel? And so I was exploring that. And one night as I went to bed, it happened pretty regularly, so I could kind of watch it unfold. And one night as I was going to bed, I picked up my alarm clock and set my alarm clock for the morning. And it was a little digital alarm clock. And as I set the alarm clock for the morning, the depression came up. It's like, it seemed so clearly tied to setting the alarm clock. But I had no clue what relationship. It's like, what? Why is it, how? What relationship is there between setting the alarm clock and loneliness? What? Not depression, loneliness. What is it? What is the connection between that? I didn't know, but I just kept observing. And over the next few days, I saw what happened in my mind when I set the alarm clock. When I set the alarm clock, a fleeting thought flew through my mind of being with my ex-partner in Disneyland. We were looking up at a marquee in Disneyland and Tomorrowland, and there was a digital clock on that marquee. That was the memory. I could see that it was connected to the digital clock that I was setting, that there was like an associative nature there. A link, a conditioned link between the clock and the memory. And then I could see, too, that the loneliness arose connected with the memory. Something along the lines of, oh, poor me, I'll never have fun things like that to do again, or something. You know, the loneliness, my idea was that the loneliness was connected to going to bed alone at night. And here it was like connected to this memory and a completely different unfolding. And so in that moment, seeing that memory and seeing how the loneliness was a conditioned based on that memory, that was kind of mind-blowing to see how that unfolded. And it's like, wow, this is not what I thought it was. This has nothing to do with going to bed alone at night. So that was surprising. More surprising was the next night when I went to bed. The loneliness, kind of noticing, expecting the loneliness to arise in a way, pick up my alarm clock, the memories there, remembering what I'd seen the night before. But what was very surprising was the loneliness did not arise. It was as if the seeing of the conditioned nature had loosened or eliminated its power to send me into that state of mind. So that's something of seeing in the moment the conditioned nature of experience. So again, we can explore from the perspective, reminding ourselves, this is nature, which can support us to hang out with something. You know, I hung out with that loneliness over the course of many nights watching it happen. And then there was this understanding of the conditioned nature of it that in that case was kind of the thing that let it release. And Another perspective that can be useful to explore is the impermanent nature of experience. Experience is a process. It's already changing even as we witness it. It's so dynamically changing. It's so dynamically changing, in fact, that there's really nothing there. Experience is without an essence. It's coreless. There's no there there. It's just this conditioned unfolding. And so that recognition of that impermanent nature can open us to the recognition, you know, when we recognize it at an experiential level, again, we can remind ourselves, sometimes the reminder of, right, this is impermanent. Again, that can help take us back to a place where we can open to that first perspective of, right, okay, it's impermanent. Maybe this frustration or this reactivity or this unpleasant experience or this state that's happening, maybe I can watch it understanding its impermanent nature. I'm just recognizing, bringing that understanding to bear, this is impermanent, can allow us to have a little more ease with, okay, I can hang out with this. I can know this as an arising in the present moment. And that perspective of seeing something as arising in the present moment, to me, that's kind of the foundation through which all of the understandings do arise. And these other, the perspective of impermanent, unreliable, can create the conditions for us to really actually be able to watch experience and then be able to see it as impermanent, to see how quickly things are changing, to see that our minds create a sense of permanence through ideas and concept, create this solidity. And what's creating the solidity is nothing more than an idea which itself is impermanent. And as we see that experientially, again, as we see the rapidly changing nature of experience directly in the moment, our mind just recognizes this is not, we cannot hang on to this. We can't cling to this. There's nothing even to cling to. And so the contraction just doesn't, the mind just doesn't tend to head in that direction. Head in the direction of trying to stop that flow of change. And so these perspectives support these perspectives of mindfulness, this natural, ordinary capacity, support the ability to actually see directly little shifts. We see in the moment, this is just anger. All right, I can be with that. Feel a little bit of space around it. That's a moment of wisdom. That's wisdom at work in our minds. See the conditioned nature. See how a thought of a memory leads to a reaction in the body, leads to a tumbling on of thought. We see that directly in the moment. And recognize that the mind can recognize that it's doing that. It's doing that creation of that reactivity. And it may begin to let it go. Again, a moment of release may be experienced around seeing, as that description around the loneliness that I described, a feeling of release there. And so there are these little moments when using this perspective of mindfulness lets us see a little shift, a little possibility of freedom, a moment of wisdom at work. Maybe sometimes we even turn to experience. At one point I was on a retreat and watching a sense of feeling abandoned. I was in the middle of a 3-month course and my teachers had left and I felt abandoned by those teachers. And I was sitting there noticing the feeling of abandonment. I felt like a 3-year-old and like, okay, I'll just be with this 3-year-old. And I was just feeling with compassion that. And then at some point I got curious about, well, what is this feeling of abandonment anyway? And it vanished. It just vanished. And I was a little curious about that. That was the first time I'd ever seen something just so thoroughly disappear. It's like I almost didn't even feel like it had been there. It just it vanished. And I went to my teacher and I told her, I said, I don't know how to observe emotions, because when I tried to observe my emotion, I said, I couldn't find it. She said, well, tell me what happened. And I described it. And she said, well, did it feel like you... like it was a problem? She said, I said, no, it just felt like it vanished. And she said, trust your experience. That was powerful, a powerful teaching for me. So these moments when we experience a shift, these are pointers. They are moments for us to trust, a taste of that awakening of the Buddha, a taste of that possibility for freedom. Gil said yesterday, he said, like, you know, maybe we just get a little taste, and then it's like then we understand the possibility for it being a broader experience. At one point years ago, he used this analogy that really just stuck in my mind. He said, you know, imagine, you know, a linoleum floor. And I have a linoleum floor that gets really dirty. You know, it's like I get down there every now and then I try to clean it. It's hard to clean linoleum. Get down there, you scrub. And he used this analogy. He said, you know, it might be that, like, you know, you can get down there and you can really scrub on this little 1 square inch of linoleum and you can get it clean. And then you understand the possibility that the entire floor could be clean. You know it's possible. It's kind of like that with these moments. It's a pointer to that possibility. It's like a pointer to that awakening of the Buddha, that capacity. It's like a direct pointing to the capacity here. This capacity exists for freedom here. This, to me, is when we get that confidence. Yes, it's possible. I trust the Buddha's awakening. I don't know that yet, but I somehow have a glimmer that yes, it's possible. That to me is refuge in the Buddha, where we have that confidence in his awakening, in that and that is a capacity that we have for ourselves. And that inspires us to continue scrubbing that linoleum, cleaning the floor, you know, and it inspires us to continue to connect with refuge in the Dharma, taking that medicine, the true refuge, as Bhikkhu Bodhi says. So let's sit for just a moment.